What's up, sports fans? Welcome to Sports Odds and Ends, the show for the fly-by-night sports fans. I'm your host, King Cash, joined as I always am by my good friend, the one, the great JVZ. What is up, my guy?
It's good to be here, Kaz. We got a whole hodgepodge of stories to get started with here.
Got some ups, some downs, and some maybe nots.
Yeah. So let's start with our first maybe not. We got the Olympics.
Tokyo 2020 or is it 2021?
I think like all the branding officially is still saying 2020.
Okay.
But it is, I guess, obviously you can't hold it in 2020 anymore.
Right.
But yeah, so I think they kept all the branding the same in the hopes that they would be able to hold the Olympics in Tokyo this year, this summer. But it looks like at least the rumors are starting to fly around that they're going to cancel the Olympics. They're still denying that. So maybe we're a little bit premature here, but we're starting to hear, at least internally, they've decided to cancel this. But publicly, they're still saying that this is going to keep going.
Right. And so I don't want to hang on this too long, because this has kind of been this big wait and see with a little bit of chess moves here and there throughout. Right. But we came into this situation where they kept trying to push it back more and more and more and more and more, to the point where they realized they weren't going to be able to do them in the year of actual 2020. And then we got to this point where everybody made these grandiose statements about safety and all these things that they were going to be able to do and all these protocols they were going to be able to follow, which even here, like, and I think almost everything I looked at kind of took the same like mentality that we did, which is how are you going to be able to assure these things, right? Because as we've seen with everything else, the problem isn't necessarily the plan you have, it's people, right? It's people, and it's what this virus does. And you can't predict those two things. One of the big things no one would predict was how rapid the virus would start to produce, or not produce, but mutate in other areas of the world where some of these players would be coming from. Which, you know, and yes, we have a vaccine, but that's still up in the air for how fast and how rapid that thing works. So there were all these questions that still hovered over this, with all of these people hand waving things in front of everyone's face about how, you know, like meticulous their planning was. And now we're sitting here again reading another story about how all of these things that we just named are the problem. It's at this point where it's just going to be this constant hand waving, this constant like, will they, won't they? And I don't know, man, it's just weird at this point. They look bad.
Yeah. And this might be a case where if they announce that they're canceling first, then certain deals go bad.
Mm-hmm.
And if they have to cancel because a bunch of people pull out due to rumors and due to the fact that they can't stake, you know, their summer plans on something that just might not happen. And if that's the case, then maybe they, you know, for insurance reasons or for some other reasons, they then get cut some sort of break on that. So it's kind of like what we were seeing last year at the start of COVID, where it almost seems like, at least that's the impression I'm getting, it's they are just hesitant to cancel anything first because legally that puts them on the hook for certain things. So
yeah, and part of it is the big price tag whole countries put on this, right? Like,
yeah,
they bid to get the Olympics in the first place. They put all this money into constructing Olympic you know, Olympic courses and places for the games to be played. And a lot of this is just tied into money, folks. Like, at the end of the day, it's just it's tied into somebody's, you know, wallet. And they want to make their money back. So it's one of those things. If there's a dollar to be made, somebody's going to try to make it, especially in a situation like this. But then at the same time, like, you can't have fans there. You can't. I don't know, man. There's so many questions. There's just always more questions than there are answers with situations like these. So,
and I think that's what's giving me the impression that this just isn't going to happen.
Yeah.
Even though the only news source that has actually, like, put their reputation on the line and said that this is not going to happen is the Times of London. And they've gone as specific as to say that that it's not going to happen, and they are now going to shift their focus to try to win another Olympic bid the next available Summer Olympic Games, which is like 12 years in the future or something like that. So that's I don't know, that sounds oddly specific for something that might not be true.
Yeah.
So other sources, we're linking to a CNN article, and they haven't been able to confirm the same thing independently. So it is still technically rumor at this point, and publicly still a denial by the Japanese government. And so they, at least officially, they're still going to try to power through. But as far as I'm concerned, those rumors are kind of on notice. So wait and see, and maybe this situation will change in about 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's move from the Olympics to the Octagon. We have some UFC news to talk about. And so no, nobody on the panel watched this particular fight, right? Nobody watched the Conor McGregor.
Correct. For Conor McGregor versus Dustin Poirier. And it was, I think I was a little surprised because it was going to at least seem betting wise like this was going to be a pretty lopsided fight in Conor McGregor's favor, mm-hmm. especially since McGregor had already beaten Poirier at one point.
Yeah.
So
there was also a thing that somebody brought to my attention.
All right, Poirier, he's Cajun.
Poirier. All right. There was something else that was brought to my attention in this loss, and that is Conor McGregor being kind of reminiscent of a lot of other great UFC title holders in history, where they reach this point where they, you know, you have so much hope for them, but they reach this point where they're more living on their name than their skill still. And if people think Conor McGregor is just hitting that plateau where he's kind of starting to, like, maybe he should step back. Yeah, no, I don't know if washed. I'm necessarily saying it. This is what I'm hearing. And I don't know enough to agree or disagree. And I got to go back and kind of, you know, assess this fight and kind of take that sense. But that's kind of what the fly-by-night is kind of speaking to, is like they're kind of comparing it to like Chuck Liddell or some of these other guys who, like, you thought they could still do it. And sometimes they could still do it, but a lot of time they just don't look like themselves anymore in the ring. And that's what people were saying, like, coming into the second round. He didn't seem like Conor McGregor. They were like, there was a lot of this going up to it that it just didn't seem like Conor McGregor for some people. So I mean, I don't know. I've been so far removed from UFC the past couple of years that, like, it's always just kind of weird, but these things kind of come and go. It happens. It happened with It happened with, you know, Chuck Liddell. It happened with Anderson Silva. Like it's just kind of the sense of fighting in it is like people start to question whether you can still do it at a certain point. And it's one of those things. It happens with combat sports where you're dominant for a few years and then you either start to look washed and then you come back and have these last few glorious fights before you're really done, or you just keep looking washed until you actually are washed and people start to worry about your health.
I think with Conor McGregor, it's especially weird because he kind of spent the latter part of his prime years, I would say, just kind of not fighting.
Mm-hmm.
and taking long periods of time off. But at the same time, he's still like, I feel like he still has the star power.
Yeah.
And that's like, to his credit, that's despite the losses that he's racked up in recent years. I think in my mind, starting with like the Nate Diaz loss. But I guess just the fact that, like, you know, that's never stopped him from talking, and that's never stopped him from kind of doing the kind of things that made him famous and made him kind of a must-see star. I think in my mind there's a contrast between that and some of the stars that are a little bit too scared about wins and losses. And Conor McGregor kind of just kept fighting no matter what, and it just realized that the draw was him fighting, not necessarily him winning. Although certainly his wins helped.
Yeah.
So it's, I think, yeah. Other than, it's because of that I hesitate to call him washed up, because I think he's still got like 3 or 4 more years of star power before he gets to like late stage Anderson Silva, where he's kind of just you know,
washed.
Late stage Anderson Silva was kind of like the guy that was like, you know, you need a substitute for a fight, hey, just call this guy up. And you know, he was at that level of star power where he wasn't even a B-level draw, but he had an A-level name and C-level skill, and I guess that made him a B-level draw. And so I think Conor McGregor is far from that for now, but I think he's out of the title. This loss kind of takes him out of the title picture at this point. The next big draw for him is a rematch of this fight, because right now he and Poirier are tied 1-1. So now they got to fight again, or Nate Diaz again. Nate Diaz is also one of those guys where, like, it doesn't matter whether he wins or loses. He kind of just, you know, people enjoy watching Nate Diaz fight. So he will always get action if he wants it. And
it's the personality, right? It's like they've kind of crafted this really good heel personality where, like, you want to see them get beat up, but you know they have the skill to actually hold their own. They're not just the mouthpiece, but, like, you get to this point where there are sometimes, and not as much as there used to be, there are sometimes these skill gaps in combat sports, right, where, like, some guys are really, really on it, and everybody else has to kind of catch up to where they are. I think Anderson Silva was one of those guys, right, where he was kind of ahead of everyone else, like, in how to fight. And everybody else kind of had to catch up to where that was. Whereas Conor McGregor and Nate Diaz share that same tact, like you said. They're more about the draw, the heel, the wanting to see them fight. This person, because they've built a thing around it, and that can last past your skill. And I totally agree with you there. Like that ability, that tact can last well past your actual skill level in fighting, and can still be a draw. Where like you compared for Anderson Silva, I think for him it's the skill, and I think guys like that are ones who are more beholden to that to that thing that I talked about, right? Where it's like, now you kind of become, you become less of a draw because you're not on the skill set anymore. So it's hard. I totally agree with you on Conor McGregor, though. It's he still has draw because he still has a mouth that he can use.
And I think if he would fight more, then we would be able to tell whether he's actually washed, and we get a little bit more data on that. But it's as long as he's doing like these one fight a year schedules, I think maybe he's being a little bit more rapid now, or frequent, I guess is the word I should say now. But other than that, I don't know. Maybe this feeling, these recent losses, might make him want to fight a little bit more often to try to reclaim his place at the top of the mountain and maybe get back into the title picture too.
My thing is, anytime part of your highlight package is them showing you training your kids, that's where I start to think you're a little washed. And that was in Conor McGregor's last highlight package coming up into this fight, was like them showing him like train with his kids, and I'm like, oh man, he's washed.
All right, I don't know. Some people get second life out of that.
We got an NHL story to talk about. What's going on here?
Yeah, I this one caught me a little bit off guard because I wasn't aware that they were doing this, but they'd started putting chips, microchips in their pucks for tracking purposes, which I mean isn't that weird of a thing.
It's not, but this is something we have been talking about with all traditional ball sports, I think, for like the life of this show, is the evolution of the gear, but the ball, right? Of whatever the item is, right? The hockey stick, the ball, the skate, the puck, the football, all of these things, in like putting sensors or gyroscopes or something in them to do more telemetry tracking and all of these kind of things. But that weirdness of like, does that throw it off? Does that, what element does that add, kind of a thing?
Yeah, so in this case, and this is like a testament to how, in a way, a testament to how much the players practice, because they were almost instantly able to notice that something was off. Mm-hmm. Even that this was off from the last time they tried to do this. The players were able to tell just from like hitting the puck and passing the puck around. So like the official pucks, there was something that they screwed up. It was something with the surfacing or whatever on the pucks that they realized this is not working. Or that it feels a little bit different than it should. So they have to go back to kind of just regular untracked pucks for a little bit. I mean, 6 days into the season, they've decided to at least temporarily scrap this until like the next batch of these come out.
Yeah.
So that they can test them. But for now, I guess this isn't the worst season to make a mistake like this and have to. I mean, because everything else is kind of, it's all up in the air too. They've changed the division structure. They've changed all this other stuff. So it's like,
and they also might be losing one of their biggest TV partners. Like,
So I didn't include that in here, but like, let's just real quick. I think NBC Sports is, at least the NBC Sports Network is getting shuttered by NBC, and so now they're going to move their hockey and NASCAR, which I think were the two biggest sports that were on that network, to the USA Network. I think, either that or move some of it over to Peacock, which I think they have been doing for some of their soccer. So I think, but at the same time, from everything I'm reading about how this might affect the NHL, it might actually be a good thing for the NHL because they get a chance to renegotiate their TV deal, which they signed back when the NHL was struggling a lot. And I mean, it's like an order of magnitude lower than what the NBA gets for their cable TV deals. So the NHL is doing a little bit better since they signed that deal, so they could get a little bit more money out of it if they did have a chance to renegotiate, or if they had a chance to kind of split up their deal among multiple networks. Right now, NBC Universal has pretty much all of their deals. So it's, I don't know, things might be changing on the horizon for the NHL, both financially and at least temporarily with the very instruments that they hit around the ice. That's going to change a little bit for at least a couple of weeks until they get their shit together.
Yeah. Like, I really want to get into this. I want to see the data for, like, the data they did collect. And I would love to see the realms in which they're testing these things before they went live puck, you know, actually on NHL ice, like if they were trying this in like junior hockey leagues or what have you, or trying this with like maybe kids and other kind of things, because I want to know, like, one, I want to know what the technology is, like what did it like is, which this article does have some of that in, but I'm just so curious because this is something I've been talking about specifically on this show a lot, mostly with football and tracking those things, because I feel like we could so much more give, and this is in a sense of giving to referees as a tool, just clear, definitive, you know, things on like, hey, that was still within the field of play. Hey, that was still like this, if the balls had some kind of sensors on it where it can track the lines it crosses or things like that. But like you said, it's one of those things where people have been using these tools in the ball itself since they are technically children for most people, and they can probably feel that difference, which was something you've said to me multiple times, like the tactile feel or just the weight difference in it and in having devices in it. So it's just, it's so, I'm so curious.
Yeah.
I'm so curious.
DGM actually asked the question, which I think is a good question, about can't NBC just buy the rights to the puck tracker from Fox, the one that they use for the Glow Puck? I'm glad you asked that question, because the Glow Puck is actually, it's the same technology used for the Glow Puck is the one that they use for the first down lines and all the other augmented reality lines on the NFL broadcasts. So it's actually, that is just camera technology. It's not anything embedded in the puck for tracking.
Yeah, that's just camera tracking.
In a way, all the Glow Puck stuff eventually is what led to the slime zone in the Nickelodeon broadcast. Like, that is the natural evolution of, you could trace that all the way back to the Glow Puck. And that is just done with a shit ton of cameras and a shit ton of computing power, to kind of match up different angles with different tracking on the field. And so, like, all that is done with computers that just crunch those numbers really quickly. Not only do they manage to crunch all those different images and lay lines, or in the case of the Glow Puck, just like an overlay over the puck. Not only are they able to do that, but they're able to do like fancy stuff. Like if a player sticks his foot over the line, they draw the line under the player as if it was on the field itself. Like you hardly ever see a misstep where they, accidentally draw the first down line over a player that's on the field. They can even do stuff like that we hardly ever notice, but actually really enhances the game. Like if it's a snow game, they can draw the field lines on the field and not just like the first down marker. They can even like show the numbers on the field. I mean, we saw it a lot last year because they experimented a little bit with showing fake digital fans. We also saw them experiment with putting like augmented reality ads on both the fields and the courts for various different sports. So, I think it was mostly due to just a lot of camera technology, which is something that both has been used for puck tracking and player tracking. So, and I know the NBA uses a shit ton of cameras for their player tracking as well. And I think like embedded chips for tracking location augment the player tracking, but it's not necessarily the end all be all of the tracking. Reverend Puck in the chat, who I know is a big hockey guy, also points out that the Fox Tracks pucks actually do have a little bit of tracking tech in them. So yeah, I think it might be a combination, but from an engineering perspective, there's more than one way to track things as they move. So using a combination of cameras and chips, you can do a lot of cool stuff. So yeah, in this case, I guess back to your point, I am interested in like all the nuances of what the players were able to say. Like, I think they mostly just didn't know, they noticed that the puck didn't slide as well on the ice. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, like I don't trust my own body, like my own arms, to be able to actually tell, like if I told somebody like, oh, this puck doesn't slide as well, and then they said, well, no, it's the same one, like I wouldn't be able to dispute that. I would just think my arms were
feeling a little different. Like if you took an item, right, and you used that singular item for a lot, I feel like you would have some tactile feedback, right? You would have some sense of like how it feels, how it moves if you used a item as much as they use a puck.
Yeah, like a little bit of muscle memory in there. Mm-hmm. I guess maybe in the same way that like you would notice if there was something a little bit off with your car, like if it sounded a little bit different. Mm-hmm. So I guess these guys are practicing that much that they're able to tell.
Yeah.
All right. I think, we'll update you guys as they figure out what they're going to do with these pucks. But for now, they're kind of going back to the old ones. All right. So it's Championship Sunday in the NFL. And we got a whole bunch of NFL news to go with. We had a slew of retirements this last week. Phillip Rivers and Drew Brees finally called it quits. I know we talked about Phillip Rivers last week, and we are already hearing rumors of Phillip Rivers maybe getting potential offers for broadcasting jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Enough that ESPN had to come out and reaffirm that they're rolling with the same Monday Night Football lineup next week or next year as they did this year, which was a pretty decent lineup. So it's kind of like all these stories kind of say the same thing. Like they want Peyton Manning. Everybody wants Peyton Manning. They can get Peyton Manning. And if Peyton Manning wants to do it, but if not, then Phillip Rivers is a nice consolation prize. If Phillip Rivers wants to do it, and it's,
put him on fucking put him on college football. Like I think that'd be the best place, but you know, what do I know?
Yeah, the more I think about it, Phillip Rivers isn't, I just don't think of him as a college football player anymore. Like the guys that you see doing college football games, I almost feel like those are guys that didn't really make it that well in the NFL, maybe with the exception of Dan Fouts. But they're kind of guys like, you know, Tim Tebow, who made the
name. I still like Tim Tebow.
Right, but it's like, I don't know. But, it's not
I know
because,
what you mean.
Like,
I know the sense of what NFL, you mean.
There's plenty of good NFL analysts that also didn't have great NFL careers.
Yeah.
So it's, yeah. So I think for now it seems like Rivers' plans are that he's going to go home to coach high school, but we'll see. Maybe if somebody backs up the money truck to him, then he'll reconsider.
As the GM says, you know, you got those kids.
And Drew Brees is the other name. I think we've kind of been eyeing it for a while, and I think he hasn't been shy about that. But it's kind of, I think, as we were recording last week's show, I think he kind of made it official that that the season would be his last one, and then they lost the game. So, in the big battle between Drew Brees and Tom Brady, and Tom Brady won out, and he gets to keep playing. I think that's how this works: is play until you lose.
Good old touchdown, Tom, ending careers.
He might have a few years left in him. At least he seems to plan that way, and he has another year left on his contract. Yep. Matt Schaub is the other, I guess, more prominent name to retire this past week. So, and for a while, Matt Schaub was having quite a decent career, and then kind of all fell apart in Houston. I think his coach for some of those years was Gary Kubiak, who also announced his retirement. I think he was serving as offensive coordinator for the Vikings this past year, but yeah, Kubiak is part of that whole Mike Shanahan, Kyle Shanahan, all those, that coaching tree from the Denver Super Bowl teams of the 90s. Chuck Pagano is, I think, the other big name coach to retire.
Yeah.
Had a bout with cancer a couple years ago, but came back, beat it. So I think, that was a nice story as it happened, but yeah, didn't do so well with the Colts, and eventually got fired. But yeah, now he's retiring. Now he's done. Wade Phillips unretired, which is kind of,
those are always the best ones.
Yeah, that's a name I haven't heard in a while, but I think by a while I mean like only 3 years or so. I didn't realize he was retired. I kind of just expected him to always be around. So yeah, so I guess good for Wade Phillips. I think the big story that DJM and I have been kind of tracking this week is the status of Matt Stafford, who I think he's kind of working with the Lions on a potential trade for him.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Adam Schefter reported yesterday that Matthew Stafford and the Lions mutually agreed to look into getting a trade for him. The story was going is that this was discussed between Stafford and the Lions even before they started making all of their coaching hires and rebuilding their front office. So it's looking like their new front office, that is growing as we record, they had known that the likelihood of Matthew Stafford not being with the Lions was in play, and they're going into it anyway. So it's looking like that. They're looking on working on a deal to trade him to another team, and it's been 12 seasons. He was drafted number one overall in 2009, and yeah, 12 seasons. It's more or less time. It's time.
Yeah.
And it's looking like the Ford family is really just kind of rebuilding the entire Lions front office staff. They're doing, it looks like Sheila Ford, the principal owner, is kind of putting together an Avengers initiative. She got Dan Campbell and Brad Holmes and now his assistant GM from the Rams, Agnew, And they just a little while ago also announced that John Dorsey will be the senior personnel executive working under Brad Holmes. John Dorsey was the general manager of the Browns, as well as the Kansas City Chiefs. He was the man for both of those teams that drafted their quarterbacks, Pat Mahomes and Baker Mayfield. Also, going back a little further, he was head of college scouting when the Green Bay Packers drafted Aaron Rodgers. So there, it seems like the Lions are really working on putting together a staff that knows how to build through the draft, which is kind of what they need to do, because now they're trading Matthew Stafford and they're not going to have a lot to work with next year. They're likely going to have a top five pick next year. And yeah, with the team as constructed, it's time for Matthew Stafford to go. It's time to make the trade. It's time to get some draft picks for him.
Yeah. And I think the appeal of coming into the job, knowing that this is going to happen, knowing that the franchise quarterback is going to be on their way out. It seems like a bad situation at first, but I don't think so.
Right. Because I
will also say, just one quick thing, guys, before you go, Dan Campbell, the head coach, did get a 6-year deal and Brad Holmes got a 5-year deal. So this was something that they clearly knew that was not going to be a short turnaround.
Yeah. I think if you look at it in a sense of, you look at it as like a cleaning of house and giving everyone a fresh start, right? You as a new coach, you don't have to come into a situation looking at it like, oh, I got to use this, right? And I got to hold on to that because this is their wonder boy kind of thing or
right.
Any kind of situation. You look at it as like, now, you know, as the new coach, as the new quarterback, this is my team, right? This is where I am. This is who I am. You know, it gives the guys who have been there for a couple years a sense of a fresh start. It gives a sense for Matthew Stafford, which we've talked about, right? Of maybe a fresh start would just be nicer. You know, maybe the same old scenery, no disrespect to Detroit, is, you know, starting to wear on him. Like there's all these senses that it could just be holistically better for everyone involved to sometimes just do it fresh.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
like I said, after 12 seasons, what else do you need to see?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's time and in a way you wish you could have made it work with this group, but it's better to give Matthew Stafford a chance while he still has talent and still has athleticism to let him take his talents to someplace else. Apparently they've been talking with the 49ers on a potential trade, which I think, I don't know, 2 months ago would have excited me, but with all these Deshaun Watson rumors flying around, excite me a little bit less. But if the 49ers went into the season with Matt Stafford instead of Jimmy Garoppolo, I'd still be pretty excited about that. But the Deshaun Watson rumors just have me a little bit too excited about that. And maybe it shouldn't, because they are just all rumors. And Deshaun Watson would certainly be a lot more costly to the Niners as far as draft picks.
I was seeing earlier today that Deshaun Watson's people were also talking with the New York Jets.
Yeah, but then he has to go to the Jets.
But then he'd be coached by Robert Saleh.
Yeah, but he's not a defensive player, so he could be coached by Kyle Shanahan.
He's got to be a leader of men. Leader of men. He might be ready to run through a wall for Robert Saleh.
That's fair. Robert Saleh does get people to run through walls. Walls of people, usually. But yeah, it's. I think either staff would probably be good. And obviously the New York market is a little bit better than the San Francisco Bay Area market. But the But I don't know if that's something he's necessarily concerned about. I think he just kind of wants to be in a stable situation, which I don't know. The 49ers always
markets don't matter anymore. Everybody's just going to find their next great player on TikTok.
It's all right. Markets matter in the NBA, but in the NFL, I think there's enough parity. There's enough shuffling around of which teams are the good ones that that I think everybody eventually, like even the Lions, can find a franchise quarterback. Whether they can capitalize on that is another story. But I think there's enough talent that ends up in every corner of the NFL to kind of balance things out. And that's part of what makes the NFL exciting to watch. So we've got the Packers and the Buccaneers in the NFC Championship game today, and the Chiefs and the Bills in the AFC Championship game. The Bills were one of those teams that struggled for a long time, and you know they got their franchise quarterback. So unfortunately, they're going up against the chosen one this week. So things aren't looking great for them, but I think this has already been a very successful season for the Bills, and yeah. I think this is the matchup that DJM called in our prediction show, Chiefs versus Bills in the AFC Championship game. So so points to him for that. As we mentioned last week, a potential chance for the State Farm Bowl with Packers and Chiefs being the two top teams. Yep, we'll see. I mean, it's we talk a lot about all these young quarterbacks, and it's like we get the Chiefs and Bills versus where you got two very young quarterbacks that are making waves very early on in their careers, and then we've got the Packers and the Buccaneers with Aaron Rodgers and Tom Brady, who I think, you know, we've talked at length about Tom Brady's age, and we've talked about Aaron Rodgers having his replacement drafted last offseason. Mm-hmm. So it's a nice contrast between old and young, and or maybe I should just say veteran and young, because those guys certainly play like they're pretty young sometimes. So yeah, by this time next week, we'll have an idea of where we'll know who's going to be in the Super Bowl. And I think we're skipping the Pro Bowl this year.
Probably. I don't know. They might. It depends on the situation. Yeah. But most likely.
Yeah. I mean, no need to fly everybody to Hawaii. No need to fly everybody in the NFL around to one city and to just hang out for a weekend, because nobody should be doing that right now.
yeah. The amount that still happens for multiple reasons is weird.
Yeah, but also if the NFL is already losing money hand over fist, I don't think they're losing that much money, but yeah, if they are already losing some money, then might as well not hold the Pro Bowl and lose even more when not that many people are going to be watching. So it's championship weekend. I think a lot of people say that this is kind of the best football weekend of the year, like quality wise, because sometimes the Super Bowl is a dud, but this weekend you always get good NFL games between the four best teams in the NFL. So
yeah, generally.
And you get all that without all the pomp of the Super Bowl, without all the spectacle. Like, these games just last 3 hours each, and that's it. And just not one 6 hour long event.
It's not your whole day.
It's, yeah.
The Super Bowl literally takes up your whole day if you plan on watching it at all. Like, it is a whole day thing. You tell people you're going to watch the Super Bowl. They're expecting you to have a plan for, like, the next, like, 36 hours.
Yeah, you got
to like,
they're
like, what are you,
all right,
what are you doing? Like, what's your Super Bowl readiness?
You got to barbecue. You got to turn it into a whole event, which don't do that this year, but it's... But as recent as last year, that's what people were doing. Even I was doing that last year because the 49ers were in the Super Bowl. But yeah, it's Super Bowl Sunday is a national holiday. I treat it like it's a national holiday. Actually, I think Super Bowl Monday should be the holiday. Like, everybody should get that day off work because nobody wants to come into work that day. So maybe it's a little different with everybody working from home or with a lot of people working from home, but that's, yeah, it'll be different this year. I think they announced 22,000 people will be allowed in the, I think Super Bowl is being held in Tampa, right? Is that correct? So in Raymond James Stadium, they will, I mean, these stadiums usually seat like 60,000 people, so they're going to have it like a third full. I think they announced that 7,000 or so will be for first responders who are vaccinated and they're basically given free tickets. So I think that's kind of a nice gesture to
They know they can't sell them anyway, so they might as well just give them away. They need seats. They need those seats filled.
Yeah, but I'm sure like all the rest of the tickets are still going to be expensive as fuck. So,
oh yeah, expensive and come with a fucking security check.
All right, so let's start off our baseball news with a pretty sad story. Hank Aaron died this week at the age of 86. I still consider him the home run king because Barry Bonds' record was. A little bit tainted. So 714 home runs. That was the previous record that that Aaron beat, and I think the final one was 754, and then that's the one something that like Bonds beat. And he managed to do this without like huge spikes in, you know, just like very consistently hitting, I want to say like 40 or 50 home runs a season and just playing for a long time, just being consistently good for a long time.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of what's, I don't want to say unique, but maybe somewhat remarkable about his record, just kind of that sustained excellence, especially doing it at a time when he was receiving just a deluge of racial abuse while he was getting closer and closer to Babe Ruth's record. So I think there's kind of a lot of stories going around this week. We linked one from the New York Times, but I'm sure you can find plenty of other ones talking about the life and career of Hank Aaron, both as a player and as an activist. So I encourage everybody to check that out because I think I think that's a part of baseball history that's sort of it's on everybody's radar, but it's starting to drift out of people's memory. So I think it's always nice to go back to that because it wasn't that long ago. There's also, I don't know, but in I heard a little bit of talk about how like maybe the Braves should, since their nickname is a bit controversial, like maybe rename their team the Hammers after Hammer and Hank Aaron. So I think that's
I think it's long enough, and I think it's long enough but fresh enough to the sense where it can mean something and it can pay homage. And it's one of those things where his name is synonymous with the history of baseball enough so that it could do that. Like it could mean enough to everyone there. So I have no problem with that. I'm sure somebody somewhere would come up with some reason why that's not a great idea, but, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, some of those people will just never be satisfied at anything. So yeah. I would support that idea. I just wish personally that I knew a little bit more about that era of baseball. Just because that's kind of the one where all the records that we know of today have been set. Even if some of them were broken during the steroids era, but I think some of us still, because of the taintedness of those steroid era records, some of us are still looking back at that Hank Aaron, Willie Mays era of baseball as the.
I was seeing some of Hank Aaron's stats earlier today, and he had a sustained career where he went from, like, I think it was 1959 to 1974 or something like that, where he had 30 home runs every year or more, except for the one where he had 29. Like that is outstanding. And he had the amount of bases he managed to accumulate is just, it's like Jerry Rice's receiving record. He has some absurd stats and absurd numbers. Just unbelievable.
Yeah, it took people going on the juice to make his records touchable. I think that's maybe the most respectful thing I could say to put those records into perspective. I'm frantically trying to look up the number, but I think somewhere on the baseball subreddit somebody said
just keep going.
It's like he ran 15 miles or so on the bases, 12 around miles, the bases, 12. Just 12 miles around the bases just from his home runs, which is incredible because it doesn't take that long to get around the bases, but throughout an entire career hitting over 700 home runs, that's a lot of distance run around the bases. So so RIP Hank Aaron. I think it'll be a while before we see a clean player challenge his record.
Yeah, but that's one of those things, because like the pitchers are also, you know, that's a whole thing.
And all that. So yeah. So I think that's kind of a nice lead into this Hall of Fame voter story, because I think people do try to factor that into their Hall of Fame voting. A lot of the steroid era guys are getting left out or being made to wait a while. And so now it's not always necessarily the accomplishments on the field that affect whether you get into the Hall of Fame or not. So right now the big controversy is around a bunch of Hall of Fame voters trying to call and revoke their votes for Curt Schilling because of his involvement and his support over the Capitol riots from a couple weeks ago, which I don't know. It's
okay. So I have said for the longest time that yes, Curt Schilling is a, well, I'm just going to say it, he's a right-wing nutjob.
He's a shitbag. For more than just that, too.
Yeah, but I don't think that necessarily precluded him from getting into the Hall of Fame. His failed gaming company and business practices in the state of Rhode Island, that was strike two. The fact that you said that, like, I had no idea that he actually supported the insurrection. I've always kind of leaned more on the side of, yeah, I don't like it, but he still should probably go in. Yeah, this was the last straw for me. I'm finally moving over to the Curt Schilling has no business being in the Baseball Hall of Fame. Because for the longest time, one of the guys that was in their respective sport Hall of Fames was somebody that people said was just a malcontent and a jackass. And that was Terrell Owens in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. So much so that he didn't even go to the ceremony. He made his own ceremony for himself because that's what T.O. does.
I'm surprised he didn't do it in his driveway while doing sit-ups. It's...
So I was kind of leaning on the side of the people that were saying, no, T.O. is kind of a dickbag. If he doesn't get in, I wouldn't be too mad about it. I'm there with Curt Schilling now. I'm there.
I think the difference is, like, Terrell, T.O.'s a dickbag, right? Like, that. There's no way around that, right? But I think for him, it's competitiveness, in a sense, whereas there's just outright dickbaggery, which is what Curt Schilling is. So, like, he's just outright, like, there's no saving him.
Yeah, and I don't know, part of the way I feel about this week's, or about this particular story coming out is just like, I don't know, like some of these people that are saying this have known that this is what this is the kind of person Curt Schilling is for a long time. And to me, like his support of the insurrection was just kind of par for the course for him. So it's like obviously, like, it was a big event, so yeah, maybe that is what got a lot of people's attention onto this is the kind of person Curt Schilling really is.
Well, so something else you kind of have to keep in mind, right, is a lot of the voters are older people most of the time, right? And some of them kind of probably come from an era where you're like, you know what? It's just about the skill. It's just about what they did on the baseball field, yada, 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 yada. And maybe the changing of the tide just kind of as it is now, like where more people are willing to talk about these things, more willing to say these things, maybe their minds are changing on some of these things outside of just like, well, did he do drugs? Well, fine, he's in. Like, I maybe it's the sense of it is turning to like who are they as a person, and does that represent what the game of baseball represents? Like, I don't know. I might be reading too much into it as well, which I think I am, because I'm sure most of these people are dickbags too.
Regarding like Baseball Hall of Fame voting and dickbags,
you make a great point about that, but when all of the dickbags agree that there's one dude that's the absolute worst of them all.
Yeah.
Like, when they all say, oh, no, not him. That's kind of where it is with Curt Schilling. Like,
these guys, at this point, it's almost like they're doing it for themselves. Like, like, oh, my God, I don't want it on my record that I voted for this guy.
Yeah.
I think it's almost a self-preservation in a way. Because at the end of the day, like all the other people that they're voting on, they can, even if it's somebody like Pete Rose, like you can make an argument one way or another. But in this case, like if you're making an argument pro Curt Schilling, it almost feels like you're supporting the Capitol insurrection. So it's at this point, he's that radioactive. So it's, I don't know, it's, yeah, I came into the segment asking, like, what changed, but I think you guys have done a great job of describing to me what changed, and it wasn't necessarily just, you know, the events of a couple weeks ago, but almost, like, an entire climate around it. Mm-hmm. So, like, I don't know, maybe you do the vote again next year, which they obviously do, but...
do understand, do right? Like, fucking of all the Hall of Fame voting, the baseball ones tend to hold on to shit the longest, right? If you're not getting in for some reason, they tend to hold on to that shit. They're like, hey, he didn't get in last time. Why? Oh, yeah, he's a piece of shit. Mm, yeah, that probably hasn't changed. Like, they hold on to that shit for a long time.
And the Baseball Hall of Fame is the one where that has the biggest effect, because it's the only one where you only have a limited period of eligibility. So you get that 10 years, that 10 year window. And if you don't get voted during that window, then that's it. You're done. So I think it's the one where those grudges have the biggest effect. Barry Bonds is not in, not just because of the stuff he injected into his body, but also because he was such a dick to the media that all of them are perfectly happy to see him get left out, despite his tremendous accomplishments. And other players as well. Like, it is definitely the pettiest out of all Hall of Fame voting, to the point where I think Dan Le Batard sold his vote to Deadspin a couple years ago, and Deadspin just turned their ballot and they just left it up to fan polling, and the fans elected a far less controversial ballot than what some reporters did. So he kind of did that as a statement, and then also lost his privilege for voting because of that. But yeah, it's almost one of those situations where the writers are so petty that that they will that they're less reasonable than the fans are, in a way. So I think this is a case of them, this particular case. While I'm not necessarily crying for Curt Schilling over this, I certainly don't believe that the writers that are changing their votes are necessarily doing it because of some moral reason, as much as they are doing it for some sort of self-serving reason.
So even to add to this, right, part of the Twitter post that is linked to this says, like, because some people don't know what the guidelines are, and voting is based upon player's record, player ability, integrity, sportsmanship, character, and contribution. Those last few things are intangibles outside of the game. You know, like your character it doesn't necessarily have to be part of the game, but that's why sometimes people who are assholes, you know, fall this way. There are some clear assholes in the Hall of Fame, in the Baseball Hall of Fame, but it's one of those things, as integrity and as in those things grow their meaning. You know what I mean? It becomes harder to just kind of say, like, what can and can't. It's the morality of the time that you have to live in. So
character matters to me. I don't think he did anything this recently that makes me feel any different about his character now than he did before. But yeah, obviously people's opinions on people change over time, and certain things can be the last straw for some people. Curt Schilling passed my last straw a long time ago, but for some people that was a couple weeks ago. So, it is interesting to see kind of the backlash to all that, and how it's, you know, we don't stick to sports because these kind of things affect both the sporting world and the political world and all around. I don't know, maybe a somewhat similar non-sticks to sports role. We've got the news about the Mets GM Jared Porter, who was fired this past week for sending 60 explicit unresponded text messages unresponded to and unsolicited text messages to a female reporter that culminated in a lewd photo of his erect penis before the reporter finally said, "Hey, you're like, leave me alone." And so, yeah, I think this story was kind of buried for a while because the particular reporter did not want to come forward with it because she was in a very precarious situation. And also, I think what kind of made this worse was I think she was a non-native English speaker. Steve Cohen, I think, as soon as the... I'm a little on the fence about Steve Cohen's role in all this because I think first the Mets came out and issued a statement, and then kind of the story broke and the details were a lot worse than I think he realized. And so, like, I think once he figured out like how bad it was, that's when he like immediately fired Jared Porter and put the kibosh on all this. But it was almost weird that like they put out a statement almost prematurely. So I don't know, it was a very weird look, but I think as soon as this got really serious publicly, the Mets just cut ties immediately. So I think the story, I don't know, it brings back to the forefront the issue of sexual harassment in sports. On top of all that, you know, it's one thing for like employees and like employees of teams, but this also affects the people that cover the sports as well. Some of which are afraid to come forward because that might affect their, I mean, it'll affect their careers. It'll affect, you know, their ability to get access to the team. General manager of a team, you know, there's role power there over between the general manager and the reporters that are covering the team. So it's, you know, it sparked a lot of conversation about like, you know, why did this person wait so long? Why did all that? And I think, you know, there are very perfectly legitimate reasons why that all happened. So I encourage everybody to look into this story and read over all the details. At the end of the day, it's, you know, this was unacceptable behavior, and I think the Mets came out very strongly to send that message. Jared Porter was a guy who got all kinds of glowing reviews for his character, and he went and did this. So, you know, like how many of the other quote unquote high character guys working in baseball or in any other sport are, you know, doing the same sort of thing, but just nobody's come forward yet. So that's just something to think about. All right. From that incident to, I guess, I don't know, something is going on in Cleveland to Kevin Porter Jr. has been traded from the Cleveland Cavaliers to the Houston Rockets for a top 55 protected pick, which is there are only 60 picks in the draft. So when you get traded for a top 55 protected pick, it means it is essentially a salary dump. It means get the fuck out. We don't care if we get anything back for you. We don't care if this pick ever conveys, but you need to go. I mean, along with this, it came with kind of a nice, you know, glowing recommendation saying like, hey, we still believe Kevin Porter Jr. is a decent guy. We hope everything works out for him, but just not here. He's been away from the team for at least up until a couple weeks ago due to, personal issues. During the NBA bubble, which the Cavs were not a part of, I think he got into various incidences with the law, although all charges for those particular incidents were dismissed. He didn't do training camp with the team. he did join the team for practice last week, but then during, I can't tell whether it was during or before the game or after the game where this happened, but he was very upset about the fact that his locker was given away to Taurean Prince, who we mentioned last week as being a part of this, the big James Harden trade, which the Cavs were a part of. So Porter came and arrived and found out that his locker was given away to Prince, and his new locker was over near the bench warmers, and he was so upset about it that he couldn't be calmed down, and apparently threw some food at general manager Kobe Altman, who was trying to calm him down. That makes him the second Cleveland Cavaliers player to throw food, the last one being J.R. Smith, who very famously threw soup at an assistant coach. I can't think of any other food throwing incidences in sports besides the ones that have happened at the Cleveland Cavaliers. So,
I mean, there's the Malice at the Palace.
Oh, you know what? That's
a lot of throwing of everything at that.
But that was a fan that did that. So, fans throw shit all the time. Yeah, players don't. Or the
there's a few incidents of that. Like, not any that come to the top of my head as quickly as J.R. Smith. So,
yeah, if you can think of them, hit us up on Twitter. I think that's the end of our show this week. Thank you all for listening. I'm at JVZ on Twitter, Kaz at King Kaz. DJM is at Call Me DJM. Hit us up with your sports food throwing stories, if you can think of them, to remind us of sports history. We always love it when you guys hit us up with stuff like that. SportsOddsAndEnds.com if you want links to this story or any of the other stories that we've discussed this week. Patreon.com/sportsoddsandends if you want to support the show financially, and thank you to all of you guys who already do that. It's enjoy championship weekend in the NFL.
Yeah.
We'll see you next week.